today on Enduring Word with David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara.
He means that this persecution that you suffer, sometimes it will come from a religious source, sometimes it'll come from a secular source, but it'll come against you. But notice here, verse 13, there's going to be good news even in the persecution, but it will turn out for you an occasion for testimony. Yes, you're going to be persecuted, but you are going to have the opportunity as you stand before that king, as you stand before that magistrate, as you stand before that governor or official, you're going to have opportunity to give testimony, and God will use it even in those instances.
Are you ready for the return of Jesus? This doesn't just mean getting ready to meet Jesus. It also means getting ready for all the events that lead up to it. In today's teaching, Pastor David lays out the signs and also the false signs that signal the return of Christ. One thing you can count on if you're a Christian is that things will not get any easier. You can expect persecution by authorities and betrayal even by family and friends. But take heart. Jesus faced this too, and he'll enable you to bear witness of him. Now, here's Pastor David with part one of his message, Witness of the Return of Jesus.
Luke chapter 21, beginning now at verse 5. We're going to go from verse 5 and take it through to the end of the chapter in our time here together on Wednesday night. And this is a very important passage of Scripture that has to do not only with what happened years ago in 70 AD, but also is what yet to happen in God's plan for the planet Earth. So let's take a look here, verse 5. Then, as some spoke of the temple, how it was adorned with beautiful stones and donations, he said, "These things which you see, the days will come in which not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down." When Jesus said those words to his disciples, if you could have seen a movie of their reaction, I bet their jaws would have dropped and their mouths would have been wide open in astonishment. They would be like, "What?" Because what they wanted Jesus to look at and what they were looking at together, Jesus and his disciples, was the temple as it stood in the days of the first century in Jerusalem. This is the famous Second Temple period, and the temple was known as Herod's Temple. Now, it's not that Herod really built the temple. It was the same temple that was built by Ezra and the returning exiles when they came back from Babylon some 400 years before this time. Yet Herod, that great, wealthy, half-Jewish man, was such an architect of vision and skill and unbelievable wealth, and he wanted to ingratiate himself with the Jewish people, that he took the rather humble temple that Ezra and the returning exiles had built hundreds of years before, and he took that temple and made it something spectacular. The Jewish temple of this period was something amazing to look at, and it was incredibly revered among the Jewish people. It was so revered that it was customary for a Jew of this period to swear by the temple. I don't know if that concept can even attach itself into our brains. In other words, you might say today, "I swear to God," which I don't advise you to do. That's kind of a way of taking the Lord's name in vain. But if somebody were to say that, you understand. Well, they would say this, "I swear to the temple." And they would mean it. That's how revered the temple was. And to speak against the temple could be considered blasphemy. That's how highly they regarded this temple. And it was beautiful. The ancient Jewish historian Josephus said that this temple was covered on the outside with gold plates that shined so brightly in the sun that you couldn't look at it. And where there wasn't covering gold plates over the outside of the temple, there was white marble. And the marble was so brilliant and so polished that visitors coming to Jerusalem from a distance looked at the Temple Mount and thought that it had to be snow. It was an amazing building. But look at what Jesus said in verse 6. "Not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down." Jesus said it very boldly. You see this great, amazing building? It's going to be leveled. Now, I don't mean any disrespect by this, please. I'm just trying to make an illustration. Think if somebody would have come in the year 2000 and taken a look at the World Trade Centers and say, see those amazing two buildings, these temples to commerce and business in the United States? You know what? In a couple of years, those things are going to be absolutely flattened. What did you see? What are you, crazy? And yet it happened. Well, it's sort of a similar kind of thing with Jesus and the attention that he's drawing to the temple. Now, verse 7. So they asked him, saying, Teacher, but when will these things be? And what sign will there be when these things are about to take place? Notice the question they ask. First of all, in verse 7, they ask, Teacher, when will these things be? They were astounded by the prediction, and so they asked a very logical question. Jesus, you say that this magnificent and strong and opulent temple, you say that this temple is going to be absolutely leveled. When? Is it going to happen soon? Is it going to happen in the distant future? And this question that the disciples asked begins one of Jesus' most famous teachings, and it's often called the Olivet Discourse. It's called the Olivet Discourse because Matthew chapter 24 makes it very plain that Jesus gave this teaching when he was on the Mount of Olives. Therefore, they call it the Olivet Discourse. Now, Matthew chapter 24 seems, at least to my judgment, to have a more complete account of this teaching. And it's helpful to answer questions from the Luke account from the more complete recording in Matthew. But this is what both Matthew and Luke make very clear, that Jesus spoke in the Olivet Discourse of two things. He spoke of the nearer destruction of Jerusalem, which would happen about 40 years after Jesus spoke those words. Actually, if you were to be technical, it'd be more about like 37, 38 years, something about that. So approximately 40 years from that time, Jerusalem would be destroyed. And Jesus' prediction has that in view, but also very clearly, he has in view not just the destruction of Jerusalem, not just the end of the temple, but also the end of the age. It's almost as if this, as if Jesus is standing from a vista point and looking off into the distance, and he sees two mountain peaks, one and then another one behind it. Now, I don't know if you know the way that the human eye and optics work and such, but sometimes you look off in the distance and you can see two mountain peaks, and from your eye's perspective, they look like they must be pretty close front to back. But if you were to go up on an airplane between them, you would say, my eye sees them being pretty close front to back, but actually there might be hundreds and hundreds of miles between the two peaks. So it's like one peak is the near destruction of Jerusalem. The more distant peak has yet to occur in our day. It is the end of the age and the second coming of Jesus Christ. You see, this chapter in Luke chapter 21 that we deal with tonight deals with matters regarding the second coming of Jesus. It's the area of theology that systematic theologians call eschatology. You don't necessarily have to remember that word. I just throw it out so you can make the connection. But it's the word eschatology, and that is, biblically speaking, the study of end times or the things regarding the end of the age. Now, I do have to always give a little bit of a disclaimer whenever I start talking about eschatology, because when Christians get together and talk about end times things, there's a lot of different opinions. Christians see things and frame things in different ways. And it's always a bit of a challenge for a teacher to deal with that, because part of me wants to turn Luke chapter 21 into a five-part series where I carefully explain the different perspectives and lay it all out. And then part of me says, look, I'm just going to teach it the way I believe it and give a little bit of reference to the way that other people might see it and bring it to you that way. And if you'd like to do more research, you can always ask questions of me or you can go and do the research on your own. But what I want you to know is that when you're dealing with things of prophecy and the second coming of Jesus, there is not a universal opinion among Christians except to say that Jesus is coming again and we must be ready. That's universal. However, I've got to say that when it comes to sort of these partisan understandings of doctrine, I'll just admit this. I don't know how to teach something that I believe as if I don't really believe it. So when I teach these things as if I really believe, I understand that there's other perspectives and there's other viewpoints out there. I just don't think they're correct. And I'm bold enough to say that I believe, and I hope this doesn't sound proud or arrogant, but from the study I've done, from the research I've done, from the investigation of the other viewpoints and sources, I think I'm right. Now, it's not always easy in this. Eschatology is a difficult subject. And this is the way I sometimes explain it to people. There are problems with everyone's approach to eschatology. I don't care which approach you take. When you start talking about the end times, you will find some difficulties in somebody's approach. But to be honest, I'll take my difficulties instead of their difficulties in my own analysis. So with all those caveats, let's look now at verse 7. What sign will there be when these things are about to take place? Now, Jesus' reply to these questions, recorded in both Matthew 24 and here in Luke chapter 21, has in mind, as I said before, both the destruction of Jerusalem in the near term and the ultimate return of Jesus Christ at the end of the age. And Luke's record focuses more, at least in this first part, on the first subject. So let's take a look now at verse 8. And he said, take heed that you be not deceived, for many will come in my name, saying, I am he. The time is drawn near. Therefore, do not go after them. The first thing that Jesus wanted them to know about this coming destruction of the temple, and as Matthew states, at the end of the age, is he wanted them to know, do not be deceived. You see, Jesus warned the disciples that many people would be deceived as they anticipated his return. And there have been times in the history of the church when rash predictions have been made. When people have got out their biblical calculations and calendars and predicted years or dates or this and that. And friends, this has been a mistake. I believe that we should live in a great sense of anticipation of the soon return of Jesus Christ. I believe that that's how he wants us to live. However, we should not set dates. We should be aware of times. We should be aware of seasons. We should have an anticipation that Jesus is coming soon. And if we see evidence that would encourage us that Jesus is coming soon, we should get excited about it and take it to heart. However, date setting is completely unadvised. I think about American history. I think about one notable example of the disappointment of prophetic expectation happened in the year 1846 with a man named William Miller. Because of William Miller's prophetic interpretations, his calculations, his publications, there were hundreds of thousands of people in the United States who were convinced that Jesus would return in 1846. When he did not, there was a great disappointment, with some falling away and some cultic groups being spawned from the prophetic fervor. This was the legacy of the great disappointment under William Miller. That's why Jesus says, look at it again in verse 8. Many will come in my name. They'll say, I am he. The time is drawn near. Therefore, do not go after them. That's what Jesus says. Don't go after these false messiahs. In the years immediately after Jesus' crucifixion and on into the first and the early part of the second century, there were many false messiahs roaming around Judea. And there's been no shortage of them ever since. Don't go after them. Do not be deceived. Now verse 9. But when you hear of wars and commotions, do not be terrified. For these things must come to pass first, but the end will not come immediately. Then he said to them, nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be great earthquakes in various places, and famines and pestilences. There will be fearful sights and great signs from heaven. Now please understand what he's saying. Look carefully at verses 9, 10, and 11, and understand what he's telling us. He's telling us that those things are not the sign of his coming. The things that he mentions. You'll hear of wars and commotions. Do not be terrified. They must come to pass first, but the end will not come immediately. That's the whole point there in verse 9. You see, Jesus specifically said that none of those things are the specific sign of his immediate coming. I like how Jesus described them as recorded in this same discourse. Again, as I said before, Matthew gives us a fuller treatment. In Matthew chapter 24, I believe it's in verse 8, he describes these things as the beginning of sorrows. And it's a very picturesque phrase in the ancient Greek. Because actually, he uses a phrase that has the intonation of, it's the beginning of labor pains. Now, I'm not a woman, and having never been a woman, I don't know the experience of giving birth. But I have it on reliable observation that labor pains have a pattern of increasing intensity and frequency until the child is born. And I think we can surmise from that, from what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 24, verse 8, that these things, wars, earthquakes, famines, pestilences, none of them in and of themselves are the sign. Now, hasn't been the tendency of human beings to think that way? Very naturally so. This is just how we're wired. A cataclysmic war happens and our world is shaken and we say, it must be the end. Jesus says, no, that's not it. A famine comes and people around us are dying of malnutrition. This must be the end. Jesus says, no, that's not it. None of those things individually are the sign, but since they are the beginning of sorrows in the sense of labor pains, we would expect that such things would become more frequent and more intense as the time of the end would approach. By the way, that gives us some reason to believe that the time of the end is on the horizon. So going on now to verse 12. But before all these things, they will lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and prisons. You will be brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake, but it will turn out for you as an occasion for testimony. Therefore, settle it in your hearts not to meditate beforehand on what you will answer, for I will give you a mouth and wisdom which all your adversaries will not be able to contradict or resist. I love what Jesus says. He goes, listen, in addition to all the things going on in the world, all the world calamities, the wars, the famines, the pestilence, the catastrophes, the earthquakes, yes, there's going to be all sorts of worldwide calamities before I come. But, hey, believer, you're also going to have your own personal little calamities. You're going to be persecuted. They're going to take you, and what did he say? You will be brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. They're going to lay their hands on you and they will persecute you. Now again, no Christian should regard any particular persecution as absolute evidence of the end. But rather we should expect that this is just what belongs to people as being followers of Jesus Christ. Notice what he says there in verse 12. He says, they'll deliver you up both to the synagogues and the prisons. Do you know what that means? He means that this persecution that you suffer, sometimes it will come from a religious source. Sometimes it'll come from a secular source. But it'll come against you. But notice here, verse 13, there's going to be good news even in the persecution. But it will turn out for you an occasion for testimony. Yes, you're going to be persecuted, but you are going to have the opportunity as you stand before that king, as you stand before that magistrate, as you stand before that governor or official, you're going to have opportunity to give testimony, and God will use it even in those instances. And friends, has not that promise of Jesus been fulfilled over and over again throughout the history of the church? Isn't it amazing how God can use men and women even in the midst of their persecution, even in the midst of their suffering in prison? But Jesus makes such a beautiful promise in verse 15. Did you notice it? He said, I will give you a mouth and wisdom which all your adversaries will not be able to contradict or resist. I kind of like how Jesus phrased that. He didn't just say in a generic way, a mouth and a testimony will be given to you. Or he didn't even say, the Spirit will give you a mouth and a testimony. Jesus made this very personal, and he said, I'm going to do it. My suffering brother or sister, Jesus says, I will be very close to you in the midst of your persecution, and I will give you a voice in the midst of your suffering. That's very powerful. That's very precious. Now look at verse 16. You will be betrayed, even by parents and brothers, relatives and friends, and they will put some of you to death, and you'll be hated by all for my name's sake, but not a hair of your head shall be lost. By your patience possess your souls. Those words in verse 16 hit us like a slap in the face. You will be betrayed. People in whom you've trusted, people who were your close friends and confidants, sometimes your own family, they will betray you unto persecution. I just imagine how many discouraged, persecuted believers have opened up their Bible to that after being betrayed, and at least they found comfort in this. Well, Jesus knew that it would be so. This didn't catch God by surprise. He told me that I would be betrayed. And because of this, some would even die. It says here, and will put some of you to death. And then verse 17, you will be hated by all for my name's sake. Friends, I just have to say, I was meditating on that particular verse, that particular line. You will be hated by all for my name's sake. And think of how crazy that is. Here is Jesus, perfect love, perfect beauty, perfect forgiveness, the most perfect man who has ever walked this earth, the man who healed the sick, the man who fed the hungry, the man who cleansed the leper, the man who died on the cross in the most self-giving, sacrificial work that this world has ever seen. And people will hate you because you're associated with him. It makes no sense, but that is the madness of a world in rebellion against God. And so he says, they'll be hated for my name's sake, but not a hair of your head shall be lost, in verse 18. Look, I got to say, I had a little bit of trouble with verse 18. Because honestly, look, just between you and me, didn't he just say a few words earlier that some of them were going to die? It's almost, yeah, and some of you are going to die. But don't worry, it's all going to be good. Jesus, die? What we realize is that Jesus is speaking very powerfully and very passionately right there from an eternal perspective, is he not? From an eternal perspective, not a hair on your head shall be lost. I don't mean to sound grotesque or mocking when I say this. It's almost as if like this, they may chop off your head, but not a hair on your head will be lost. In an eternal perspective, God's got it all under control. Don't worry, you are my child. That's something that Jesus could only say with an eternal perspective in mind. Now verse 20, and we're going to read through the middle of verse 24. He says, but when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of her depart, and let not those who are in the country enter her. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. But woe to those who are pregnant, and to those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be great distress in the land, and wrath upon this people, and they will fall by the edge of the sword and be led away captive into all nations. Jesus warned his listeners, and he warned them knowing these words would be recorded and available for a generation to come. And he warned them about the attack that would come upon Jerusalem in approximately 70 AD.
There's much more Pastor David would like to share with you, but we've run out of time for today. This has been another edition of Enduring Word, the radio ministry of David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel in Santa Barbara, California. Pastor David will continue teaching verse by verse through the Gospel of Luke next time. You can order today's message for free by emailing us at radio@enduringword.com. Again, that address is radio@enduringword.com. Sometimes it is just easier to call. Our phone number here at the church is 805-730-1400. We'll be happy to help you. Again, that number to call is 805-730-1400. Now, here's Pastor David with some great information about the Enduring Word Commentary Series.
Hi, this is Pastor David Guzik. Over the years, God has led me to write simple Bible commentary through almost the whole Bible. At EnduringWord.com, you'll find free Bible resources that'll help you as you study God's Word. We're making these commentaries available in written format as well as audio. Here's Josh with more information about how you can support Enduring Word.
Thanks, Pastor David. We'd like to encourage you to consider supporting Enduring Word by partnering with us with a one-time gift or monthly donation. Your support helps this program extend its reach worldwide. Well, that's all the time we have for today. From all of the production team here at Enduring Word, we want to say thank you for tuning in. Next time, Pastor David will continue teaching through the Gospel of Luke. That's next time on Enduring Word.